It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered! Oh!
You like fighting a woman?
You got grown-ass wrestlers in the back going on Twitter.
Come over here and fight me.
Don't speak, bitch. Come on now.
You have legs.
They've made Solo a monster.
I was 99% positive it was just chest up.
No.
I want out of my contract if I don't get what I want.
One year ago this week, within 24 hours of each other, we lost one of the greatest of all time in Terry Funk. And a year ago to this very day, we lost Bray Wyatt at the age of 36. To call it shocking would be an understatement. Just a terrible loss. You know, four children at home, a few months before he and his fiance were set to be married. In the decade or so that he spent before that, as the Bray Wyatt character, he went through a few different transformations. He went from Swamp Family Leader to The Fiend to being himself, you know, his genuine self, the last we saw of him. That was the start of the Uncle Howdy stuff, where he got the chance, however brief it was, to work with his brother. They never got the chance to see that storyline through. But now we have the Wyatt Six, and this is Bo Dallas's attempt to resume that story and keep his brother's vision alive and the characters that he helped create. You know, they've gotten over so far. This Monday, Uncle Howdy wrestles his first match ever against Chad Gable. This will actually be Bo Dallas's first match in 5 years. The last time we saw him in a match on TV, it was an episode of Raw on August 26, 2019. And now on August 26, 2024, he returns to the ring. There's no way they didn't time it to the day like that by accident. I hope he does well. I'd like to see everybody involved in the Wyatt Six stuff do well, even after they eventually branch away from it. But I think it's very cool that Bray's influence can still be felt on this show, and his influence will be felt for some time to come. You know, I went back and I watched the return at Extreme Rules 2 years ago when he came out at the end of the show. You know, he stepped out, and when he pulled the mask off, the Uncle Howdy mask, and just the reaction from everybody in the building that night, it was one of those moments that you don't forget. And to see him have the chance to come back and almost throw it in their faces, like, you know, you got rid of me, you discarded me, and now I get to come back and show you what you missed out on this entire time. And it's very sad that he never got the chance to finish that story out. This is episode 876. Of the Solo Monster Sounds Off for Saturday, August 24th, 2024. Usually it's a Sunday. Today it's a Saturday because it is All In weekend. We got a big pay-per-view coming up tomorrow starting at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. So no bueno when it comes to recording the sound off, so you're getting it a day early. I want to say thank you to all of our PayPal producers. If any of the late donators have not gotten it in yet, I will be sure to include you next week. But I want to say thank you to the Portland pop star Paul Hamilton, Big B Brian Becerra, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soap, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, the Cleric of Destruction, Eric Zyangs, Night Stalker Nayef Alsafar, Eric First Blood Fisher, Tough Guy Temjin Zephyr, Best in the Game Trey Porter, the Chicago Slayer Willie Eichert, Josh Bad Medicine Medina, who says this year marks 10 years of him listening to the Sound Off, and it's the only podcast that he consistently listens to every week. Josh, thank you very much. Dashing David Brown, who wants to give a shout out to his good friends Martin, Craig, Stephen, Ryan, and the rest of the group. For we are in London, he says, to enjoy All In weekend. So have fun, David. I've never been, but it looks like everyone's having a good time over there. The Natural Disaster, Chris Farmer from Brandon, Manitoba. Thank you for the kind donation. That was very nice of you. I have not visited Fort Lauderdale, as he asked me, so I cannot help you with the recommendations. But if somebody wants to chime in with something cool to do in Fort Lauderdale or a great place to eat, I will pass that along to Chris, who is headed there in January. Show Your Role, Chris Ludek. Check out his YouTube series, What Could Have Been in Wrestling. Just search for Chris Ludeck. That's L-U-D-E-C-K-E. And What Could Have Been in Wrestling. And Chris from Bethlehem wants to give a special anniversary shout out to his bride, Angelina, who also listens to the show, I'm told. So happy anniversary to you both. Here's to the next five. Now, I've got predictions, both AEW and WWE, and I'm also going to be going through my top 25 countdown. I call it a countdown, but it's not a ranked list, but it's my 25 favorite matches and moments in SmackDown history. Because the 25th anniversary of SmackDown becoming a weekly television series is this Monday. And it's been a while since I've done one of these lists, which I know you enjoy. So that's coming up a little bit later, plus your questions. Let's start with AEW, though. Tomorrow is AEW All In London, back at Wembley Stadium for the second straight year. With a 1 p.m. Eastern start time, I will be live on YouTube for the post show as soon as the event ends. 2 weeks ago, I told you they had about 45,000 tickets out for the show. They have moved over 5,000 more since then. So they may be able to announce a number between 55 and 60,000 by showtime, which is an excellent number. Now, it is down from 80,000, but you put 50,000 people in any building, especially at some of the prices they were charging, that's nothing to scoff at. And I'm excited for the top matches. The entire card looks good, but the top matches especially I'm hyped for. I don't worry about these AEW pay-per-views other than the length. When it comes to match quality, I don't worry about it. They usually hit a home run with these things. The zero-hour pre-show is 2 hours long, and I am certain we're going to get at least one more match announced for it tonight, probably on Collision. But Collision has not happened yet as I am recording this. So right now there's only one match with Willow Nightingale and Tomohiro Ishii facing off with Chris Statlander and Stokely Hathaway. With the winning team picking the stipulation for the CMLL Women's World title match at All Out between Statlander and Willow. Statlander already pinned Nightingale in an eliminator match to earn the right to challenge her for the title. I think Willow gets to pick the stip. This is a fine buffer, I think, between the two matches. Tony Khan has another pay-per-view to book, so him saving the title match for Chicago makes sense. I'm going with Willow and Ishii for the win. We have a London ladder match for the Trios Championship with the Patriarchy, defending their titles against the House of Black, the Bang Bang Gang, and a fourth team to be determined tonight on Collision in a match pitting Leo Rush and Top Flight against Claudio Castagnoli, Wheeler Yuta, and the Bastard Pack. It's clear that the spot was supposed to go to Death Triangle, but with the Lucha Bros on their way out, that left Pack without any partners, and so they just stuck him with the Blackpool Combat Club. Pack's Wembley moment will be being on the show, it looks like, because it doesn't make any sense for him to win the belts with the BCC. Right, what does make sense to me would be Juice Robinson and the Guns winning their belts back. So I think it's either they win them back or the Patriarchy retains. I'm going with the Gang to regain the titles. Chris Jericho, who will be played to the ring for the second year in a row by Fozzy, defends the FTW Championship against Hook. If Hook does not win the title, he can never challenge for it again. Hook won the FTW belt at last year's Wembley show against Jack Perry. That's where we got the whole real glass, cry me a river, which set off a whole firestorm and led to CM Punk being back in WWE. But that was a year ago. Hook was wrestling for the FTW belt. He is still stuck fighting for a championship that does not even officially, that is not officially recognized by the company. So Hook is going to win the belt back, and the sooner this is all over, the happier I will be. And if we don't get Taz getting up off commentary and locking Jericho in the Taz mission, then I don't know what we're doing here. Because it seems like they've been building to that spot, you know, with Taz getting his hands on Jericho. I know he can't take any bumps, but he certainly can lock him in a Taz mission for a few seconds, one would think. And with any luck, he'll put Jericho to sleep and we won't see Jericho for a few months on TV. Give him a little refresh. Let him take a little vacation. Maybe he can do a mid-year Jericho cruise. I think that would be best for all involved. Of course, I just had a thought. Well, let me talk about this match first. We have a casino gauntlet match for a guaranteed shot at the AEW World Championship. Hangman Adam Page is officially in. He was the first name to declare. as are Orange Cassidy, Kyle O'Reilly, Mark Briscoe, Roderick Strong, and Evil Uno, plus some surprises. One of which, if you do not want any spoilers, skip ahead, because there is one name that I think we are going to get in this match. And that name is Ricochet. Fightful is reporting that he has signed a multi-year deal with AEW, and he is traveling to London for the show. He's probably already there. What his role will be, they did not say, but the gauntlet match is wide open. And Tony Khan has already said there's going to be some surprises. There's always surprises in these casino gauntlet matches. This is the third one they're doing in the last 4 months. So I think they may need to cool down a little bit with these. I like the concept. The last one was a lot of fun. But doing them every other month, I don't think that's such a smart move. Ricochet, I think, is going to be in it. I don't think he's going to win. This match, I think, is Hangman's for the taking. And it's a gauntlet match, so it's one fall to a finish. The match could end at any moment before everybody is even in the match. So it's one of those situations where, okay, Ricochet may not win, but he gets to show up, he gets to show off, and doesn't have to take the losing fall. So it's not like he has to get pinned. But what I was going to say before, I was talking about Jericho and how I think he should take some time off. Poor Ricochet, you know, coming in. I could just see it now, you know. Jericho loses the FTW title to Hook. And it's like, well, who's he going to sink his hooks into next? What's Jericho going to do next? And it's like, hey, Ricochet, come sit under the learning tree. Give me a fucking break. This gauntlet is Hangman's for the taking. I think this is how he wins his way to a world championship match, maybe as soon as All Out. We have the Young Bucks defending the AEW tag team titles, something they have not done but once since winning the belts in April, defending against FTR and the Acclaimed. As I said, up until 2 weeks ago, the Bucks had not defended these titles since winning them at Dynasty. The Acclaimed won an eliminator match for a shot at the titles. But that match ended by DQ when FTR got involved. FTR has been beefing with the Acclaimed. FTR then wrestled the Acclaimed in a match that went to a 30-minute draw, so Tony Khan made it a three-way at Wembley Stadium. Much like Hook last year, fighting for the FTW title and doing so again this year, for the second year in a row, it is the Bucks and FTR for the titles, this time with the Acclaimed sprinkled in, a little side of the Acclaimed. That does not make this match any more appealing to me. It'll be a good match, but the build to this has been a bust. This is as cold and uninteresting as the tag team scene has been in AEW since the company started 5 years ago. And I hope they can turn it around because it's not for lack of talent. You look up and down that roster, they got plenty of that, but they got to shape up. As far as this tag team scene is concerned and what they're doing with it, I think the Bucks retain. I think they're going to keep the gold in the Elite. Mercedes Moné defends the TBS Championship against Dr. Britt Baker. This is a match between two of the biggest names in the women's division. In Britt Baker, you have somebody who the division has been built around since day one. She has been the face of the AEW women's division since the formation of this company. And she has been a world champion before. Now she's challenging for a different title. Mercedes comes in with a pedigree and a name from other places. And she comes in and you have this first ever match, which should feel like a bigger deal than it does. The buildup has been very spotty. It has not been great. It started out with some promise and then it kind of petered out. You know, Britt getting suspended and being off TV for 2 weeks didn't help. That segment on Wednesday, though, was a nice little rebound from some of the other segments they've done recently. And Mercedes, I think, has been outshined at every turn on the microphone by Britt Baker. Now, what will happen when the bell rings and they get in the ring together, I'm very curious to see. Because we've seen Britt Baker get in the ring with certain people and have great matches, and we've seen her get in the ring with certain people and not have great matches. Mercedes is a great wrestler. Mercedes, more often than not, goes in there and has very good matches. I'm expecting this to be a very good match. I am not expecting a title change. Mercedes is going to retain, as she should, her TBS championship. The bigger question is, do we get a Jamie Hayter return when this match is over? Now, I've seen the same reports that many of you have seen about Britt Baker and Jamie Hayter, they don't get along. Apparently, Britt Baker and Jamie Hayter have not been friendly for quite some time. That should not preclude her, though, from making an appearance here and coming to the aid of Britt Baker, who perhaps is being double-teamed when the match is over by Mercedes and Camille. Who is the perfect person to show up and counter Camille? Jamie Hayter. We have not seen Jamie Hayter in over a year. I don't know what mystery injury she's been dealing with. Maybe it's multiple injuries. Clearly, whatever it was very serious. She has been off television. She has been off social media. I don't know what she looks like. I don't know anything that's going on with Jamie Hayter. She is a mystery right now. But in London, of all places, in Wembley, for them to hit her music and for her to come out and make her grand return would be a great moment. And that is what I am hoping for. And then you would get, you know, the obvious match to do would be Britt and Jamie against Mercedes and Camille, and they can turn around 2 weeks later at All Out and do that match. And then coming out of that tag match, you have any number of singles matches that you can do involving those four. That's what I'm hoping to see. We have Darby Allin challenging Jack Perry in a coffin match for the TNT Championship. Why a coffin match, you ask? I'm glad you asked. Darby said that he has already set Jack Perry on fire. He has already beat him bloody in Blood and Guts. And there is only one place to go from here. And he does not want a year-long feud with Jack. He wants to end this at Wembley. I think it does end there. But I think Perry is going to hold on to the title. It would be a shame for him to drop it after he did such a badass job on the new design. What a waste that would be. And Darby is already guaranteed a world championship match at Grand Slam next month. He doesn't need to walk in with the TNT title. Another win for the Elite. Timeless Toni Storm defends the AEW Women's World Championship against Mariah May. Sweet Mariah. She has done tremendous work here in AEW so far, especially since the turn on Toni Storm, which is one of the greatest segments ever in the history of Dynamite. This storyline has been playing out for the entire year. Maybe even going back to the very end of 2023. But for the duration of 2024, it's been all about Toni and Mariah, and it was always building to this moment. Now, Mina Shirakawa is stateside. Again, I saw that she's been hanging out with Kairi Sane, actually. I saw some photos of them on social media. Might she factor into this finish? You know, does she help Mariah win? Or does Mariah win and then set up a match for All Out between her and Mina for the title? I don't know, but I think that this will end up being a bloody affair for both women. We saw Toni bleed in the angle a few weeks ago. I think both women are going to end up getting color in this match. And I think that this match has the potential to be one of the show stealers. It's hard to say that it will steal the show on a show that has Will Ospreay, frankly, in any match, let alone in there with MJF. But this is one of the matches I am most looking forward to on this show. They've done a tremendous job with the story. It does feel like the last few weeks it's calmed down because they just didn't have a whole lot to do. But we've been able to see the more sinister side of Mariah May, which is nice. The side of her that we really haven't gotten to see up until the last few weeks. I have big expectations for this match, and I am expecting a new champion to be crowned. If it's me, I mean, Toni Storm now has been the champion for, when did she win that title? Was it, what? It was probably not long after All In last year. Maybe Full Gear? She's had that title for almost a year. So it feels like the right time for Mariah to win the gold. Now, it was the promos that carried the day on Wednesday's show. I know Tony Khan likes to say that AEW is where the best wrestle, but it was that Bryan Danielson promo on Swerve and the MJF Will Ospreay segment that really sold this show for me. I thought that was a great final hard sell for this pay-per-view. And it will be MJF defending the AEW International / American Championship against Will Ospreay. Defending the American title, but Ospreay has said that he will restore the international title when he wins it. MJF said the quiet part out loud on Wednesday when he said that the fans did love him. They did used to love him until Ospreay showed up. That jealousy reared its ugly head, and really that is the basis for how we got to this point in this storyline. That and the angle where MJF killed Daniel Garcia, who may or may not be sticking around with AEW, we don't know yet. If he is, he might show up here. But the other story involves the Tiger Driver 91 spot that Ospreay nearly crippled Bryan Danielson with in their match at Dynasty. Ospreay has refused to use that move ever since. On Wednesday, Bryan walked right up to him in the back and told him, "Do it." Clearly in reference to using the move in his match with MJF. Do it. And I, even before that, figured that's how he wins the title and that's how the match ends, is with the Tiger Driver. Or he hits the Tiger Driver and then follows that up with the Hidden Blade and then wins. So maybe he doesn't win it with the Tiger Driver per se, but he should. Because I feel like that's what this has all been building to this entire time. I think Ospreay is winning the championship back. I'm picking him to win. Look, he lost to Swerve at Forbidden Door. That was his first loss since signing with AEW. Then he lost his belt to MJF in their 60-minute match on TV. Ospreay needs to win here, in his home country. He has said that he will restore the international title when he does. I think MJF, though, should keep that American championship around. I think that could be his belt for a while. Pac is still owed an international title match. I think we get Ospreay defending against him at All Out. And in the main event, the American Dragon Bryan Danielson puts his career on the line against Swerve Strickland, who puts his AEW World Championship on the line. Title versus career. I think they gave the finish away when they added that stipulation. We'll see if I'm right. I think Tony Khan is going for the feel-good moment to close the show of Bryan winning his first championship in AEW. I think he wants him to be part of that title lineage. And he knows that this is maybe the last big match of Bryan's run there. He's working without a contract, by the way. This is what they claim. This is what Bryan himself has claimed. His contract ran out August 1st. He has not signed a new deal. He doesn't know if he wants to sign a new deal. So think about that. This man is headlining Tony Khan's big stadium show tomorrow night for the World Championship and is not under contract. And if it was anybody other than Bryan Danielson, I'd say this guy's fucking nuts and he's out of his mind. But Bryan's, he's not going to do anything nefarious. He has openly talked about how much he has loved his time in AEW, how much he still enjoys his time in AEW, and plans to still be a part of AEW for many more years to come, with or without a long-term contract. But in this storyline, all the talk of self-doubt, all the talk of his injured neck, I think it's all to build to this moment with him winning the title. For whatever talk there may be about AEW dropping the ball with Swerve, let's keep this in mind, okay? He beat Samoa Joe to win the championship. He beat Christian Cage. He was the first man to beat Will Ospreay. He led his team to victory in Blood and Guts. Now he's headlining their biggest show of the year against one of the greatest of all time. And he still has future matches already lined up with Hangman Page and possibly MJF, because they've continued to drop little comments towards each other. I think Swerve has done pretty well for himself. You know, maybe early on in this run and him not being in the main event at Double or Nothing because they wanted to put Anarchy in the Arena in the main event, there were definitely questions about how is Tony Khan booking and positioning Swerve Strickland. Here now, as I sit here in August, almost September, I think he's done pretty well for himself. And even if he loses here, doesn't mean that he's out of the main event scene. I think this goes one of two ways. My prediction is Bryan Danielson wins the AEW World Heavyweight Championship. He defends against Darby Allin in Grand Slam, and then he drops the belt back to Swerve in Tacoma at WrestleDream. That's on October 12th. Either back to Swerve or possibly to Hangman Page, and then Swerve has to chase Hangman to get the belt back. The other way this goes, now that's my prediction, but the other way this goes, if it doesn't go that way, would be Swerve retains, which at this point would be a surprise to me. But then Hangman, after winning the gauntlet, gets his shot 2 weeks later at All Out, and he beats Swerve on that show in Chicago to win the world title. It's harder for me to see Danielson losing here, though, given the stipulation. It all comes back to that retirement stip. I don't think that this is something Bryan would go back on his word for. If he says that he's done, if he loses here, I believe him. I think he's done. But I don't think he's done yet. Now, there was signage up around the stadium on Friday advertising next year's Forbidden Door pay-per-view will be taking place in London. It did not give a date or a venue. Maybe Wembley Arena, right? The arena is right next to the stadium. They usually hold it in late June. Next year, you know, we have All In Texas on July 12th. So that would be a pretty quick turnaround between the two shows. We'll see if they move Forbidden Door or if they keep it right where it is, usually. This will be the second time Forbidden Door has gone international. Last year, they were in Toronto. And the second Forbidden Door-style event of the year. Because remember, AEW and Ring of Honor talent are going to be part of that New Japan Wrestle Dynasty show at the Tokyo Dome on January 5th. AEW will be playing a very big role in that. Now, there was also a sign indicating a return to London in 2026, which Tony Khan had already said previously. He just has not said that they will be back at Wembley Stadium, only that they will be returning in 2026 for All In. So that is the update on those shows. And like I said before, I will be live on YouTube whenever All In is over on Sunday evening, late afternoon, early evening. Hit up the YouTube channel. I will be live and we'll talk about it. Now, the latest on a new media rights deal for AEW with Warner Brothers Discovery comes to us from Fightful Select. It's speaking with a number of sources from both places. Warner sources confirm there is still some red tape that they have to get through, but another offer, that was the language they used, another offer, which implies there was at least one previous offer, for a long-term deal was made recently to AEW that they are very confident in. They're told the deal came after the recent meeting in Paris at the Olympics with Tony Khan and David Zaslav. One Warner Brothers Discovery source called the offer extensive, but did not elaborate on what that meant outside of saying the terms of the deal were literally extensive. But that offer is now in AEW's hands and they are currently reviewing it. I would assume that anything extensive would have to include a streaming component on Max. I can't imagine it wouldn't. I saw Tony Khan wearing a Max hat during an interview this week. I would not read too much into that. He probably pulled that out of his goodie bag they gave him when he walked into his hotel room in France. Had all the Warner Brothers Discovery goodies in the bag. But the story says sources close to the situation said that even previous to the most recent offer, AEW had been offered at least double the amount of their previous deal. The story notes there are no publicly available numbers for their current television deal, and that deal has evolved greatly over the body of the deal. It's also worth noting that we don't know if at least double is for the same amount of programming or if additional elements are involved. AEW currently has Dynamite, Collision, Rampage worked into their deal, as well as exclusivity for AEW programming, which is why AEW Dark no longer appears on YouTube. We are told that any and all combinations and possibilities have been explored. There were rumors internally that Warner Brothers Discovery had discussed a shift in pay-per-view strategy as it pertained to AEW, but they did not respond when we reached for comment on that. Sources in Warner Brothers Discovery and AEW continue to be steadfast in claiming that they have been in ongoing conversations regarding a new deal or adjustments to their deal and how to continue working together since last year. Sources from each side expect the partnership to continue for years to come. It's going to be a long-term deal. It's going to be a deal for more money than they're making now, at least double, with a streaming component involved, and maybe even a slot for Ring of Honor. That is what I am thinking. It will be the biggest deal that Tony Khan ever makes for his company, and one would think would make them profitable by next year. What I'd like to see out of it? Don't expand Dynamite to 3 hours, please. I know there's been talk about that. They've experimented with this, you know, because sometimes the shows get bounced around because of sports. So there have been occasions where they've tacked on Rampage to the end of Dynamite, and we got an 8 to 11 p.m. block like we have for Raw on Monday nights. I don't want to see that. I don't want to see it. You might want to see that. I have no interest in a weekly 3-hour AEW show. Any more than I have interest, frankly, in a 3-hour weekly WWE show. And I say that as somebody who's been enjoying the hell out of Monday Night Raw. Raw has consistently been the best weekly show now for weeks. And I still wish it was 2 hours long. Leave me wanting more. So I don't want to see Dynamite go to 3 hours. I mean, they're going to do what they need to do. I mean, if Warner Brothers Discovery wants them to go 3 hours, then of course you do what you need to do. But just speaking personally, I don't want to see that. Put the pay-per-views on Max, but without the UFC model. There's a chance it may work that way, where you have to pay, you still have to pay $50 for every show, but you pay an additional monthly fee for Max on top of that. That's how it basically works now with UFC. I don't want to see that. I'm hoping that's not the way it's structured. And get the library up on Max so people can access all the past AEW shows and Ring of Honor, you know, because content is king. Even if they end up not having an interest in Ring of Honor per se, there's a lot of content on there in that Ring of Honor library that features current AEW talent. So I think the quicker they get all that content up on a streaming platform like Max, the happier everybody will be, because right now there's no easy and quick way. There's no one-stop shop to go back and access 5 years worth of content plus Ring of Honor. Yeah, you got Honor Club for that. It's kind of fragmented, but to have it all in one place, the way you have the WWE content right now on Peacock, would be the way to go. AEW is not the only company with a pay-per-view coming up. Before I record next week's Sound Off, the Bash in Berlin will be in the books. So now is as good a time as any to run through the card and give my predictions. Like All In, this card has a 1 p.m. start time. We have back-to-back international PLEs here on back-to-back weekends, both with a 1 o'clock Eastern start time. This one is emanating from the Uber Arena in Berlin, Germany, the first ever German PLE for WWE. Those fans have a tall order ahead of them if they want to beat out that crowd in Lyon, France for Backlash, but it'll be fun to watch them try. Randy Orton has said he's flying his wife to the show with him because he wants her to experience the atmosphere in the building. He thinks it's going to be nuts, and I tend to agree. It's another five-match card. We already had the Bloodline defending the SmackDown Tag Team titles against the Street Profits on Friday, and LA Knight defending his U.S. title against Santos Escobar. LA Knight is going to be in Berlin, but he will be having an open challenge on SmackDown next Friday for the United States Championship. Jey Uso and Sami Zayn, they've teased going after the Judgment Day for the Raw Tag Team titles, but then on Monday, Jay said that Sammy was taking some time for himself, and he added his name to the mix for this intercontinental title tournament that is about to kick off on Monday for Bron Breakker's title. We don't know who's in it yet. Sounds like Jay is a lock. So I assume we're not getting any men's tag team title defenses on this show. We have not had a single defense of either set of tag team titles since WrestleMania, and that was when they were still unified. Since then, nothing. But we've had several women's tag team title defenses. Clash at the Castle. We had Alba Fire and Isla Dawn winning the belts from Bianca Belair and Jade Cargill. And now they're going to be defending those titles in Berlin against Bianca and Jade. And I think Bianca and Jade are winning the belts back. I do not see them losing twice to Alba Fire and Isla Dawn. I think they gave the win to Alba and Isla because of where they were. Especially, you know, for Alba in particular, that was a very emotional time. I think I mentioned that her mother had been killed by a driver. She was actually hit by a car when she was in Florida, I think, visiting. And this was just weeks before that show, maybe the month before. So that was a big moment for them when they won the titles over there in Scotland. But now we're in Berlin. Now it's 2 months later. And now I think it's time for Bianca and Jay to get the belts back, which is what I think is going to happen. Damian Priest and Rhea Ripley, the Terror Twins, take on Liv Morgan and Dominic Mysterio in a mixed tag team match. This is the best storyline going on Raw right now. Priest and Ripley, they came out of SummerSlam as losers. They need this win. I think they get this win. And that sends Rhea onto Bad Blood to challenge Liv for the Women's Championship. The only question is, does Rhea hit Riptide on Dom here, or do they hold off on that for Bad Blood? I say we get it here. And it'll blow the roof off the place if she hits it. CM Punk announced on Monday the stipulation for his match with Drew McIntyre. It will be a strap match, where the object is to touch all four corners of the ring in succession to win the match. I was not thrilled with that Punk promo on Monday, much to the chagrin of all the Punkers and the Punkettes who populated my timeline, big mad over my opinion. They were big mad. Well, be mad. The segment sucked. One bad segment among many great ones that we have had this year with Punk and McIntyre. I don't know why that upsets people so much. I really don't. I'll send you all a bracelet with my name on it. Me and my dog's name. It'll make you feel better. I don't even have a dog. I'll put Larry's name on there. That way you can wear it with you to bed at night to make you feel safe. I was thinking that maybe there would be some more controversy with the stipulation and they were going to give McIntyre another win while protecting Punk from taking the pinfall loss, but I don't know why I thought that. This is going to be a CM Punk win to even the score at one win apiece heading into their inevitable Hell in a Cell clash. The focus on Monday was still very much on Punk's bracelet, which just a week earlier he said McIntyre could keep. He didn't need it back. It's what it represented. You want to keep it? Go ahead and keep it. But then on Monday, he said he would drop the strap and agree to fight Drew right then and there if Drew would give him back the bracelet. So that was strange. Clearly, he does want the physical bracelet back. And he will get it back at some point. He'll probably get it back in Berlin. But yeah, Hell in a Cell of bad blood seems inevitable with these two. It makes more sense for them to be split one win apiece going into the finale. Cody Rhodes defends the WWE Championship against Kevin Owens. When you don't have enough heels for your champion to work with, you go to another top babyface. Owens did not want the shot. He's a very proud man. Has not had the best win-loss record this year, but Cody insisted. You know, Owens has had his back at every turn with the bloodline going all the way back to last year's WrestleMania. Remember when Sammy and KO fought off the Usos and you thought, this is going to be it. And then he got spiked and he lost. But Kevin Owens was there to help him out. Cody is not losing the title, but Owens going heel is a very real possibility after the match. On SmackDown Friday night, it was all about building up some doubt in what Owens' intentions are. They even had a video package showing all the times that he betrayed friends of his or turned on people, Sami Zayn and Chris Jericho and Kofi Kingston, among others. So they really want you to think that this man, he can't be trusted. You got to keep an eye on him. And maybe, just maybe, he's going to betray Cody Rhodes just like he did all those other people. Almost to the point where it makes me think that it's not going to happen. Because why lean so heavily into it? But it does add an interesting little wrinkle to the match that wasn't there before. Will he or won't he? One thing I will tell you that he will not do is win the WWE title. Cody Rhodes is going to retain. Whether or not Owens goes heel, I put it at 50-50, honestly. Because I think Randy Orton's going to go heel. So do they both go heel? Does Owens go heel and not Randy? Because they could definitely use some heels on top of that show right now. I mean, the roster imbalance as far as heels and babyfaces on top is very noticeable. And it has been noticeable as far as Cody's reign is concerned. So they could definitely use someone like KO back in the heel spot. I'm 50-50 on whether or not they pull the trigger and actually do it. And in what I think will be and should be the main event, Gunther walks into Berlin, the defending world heavyweight champion for the very first time, putting his title on the line against Randy Orton in a rematch from this year's King of the Ring final. Orton has also said he hopes they get to main event the show. He said, and I didn't realize this, he said it's been almost 4 years. 4 years since he has had a main event match on a PLE. Not counting War Games last year. I assume he's counting, you know, singles matches, maybe tag matches. 4 years. I'm expecting Gunther to get a great reception, given that he won't be too far from his home country. He's not dropping the title 4 weeks after winning the championship. And when Randy loses, again, if they want to, they have the perfect setup for a heel turn and a program with Cody Rhodes for the other belt. At what point does the losing streak end, right? Not a single PLE win for Randy Orton all year. He's been a loser time and time and time again and will be this weekend or next weekend. And at what point does he say enough is enough? You know, Cody went and gifted Kevin Owens a title shot. Does Randy come back to SmackDown and expect the same treatment? He's been right there with KO, watching Cody's back for the past several months. It would only be fair for Cody to extend the same courtesy to him that he did to Kevin Owens. But that's where Randy's future lies. It lies with Cody and the WWE title, not the World Heavyweight title. So Gunther is going to retain. The better question is who he defends against next. Seth Rollins is going to be occupied with Bronson Reed when he returns. And Rollins already had his shot of Money in the Bank anyway. Punk and McIntyre, they're still joined at the hip, or the wrist, as it were. They could surely get a PLE match out of Sheamus and Gunther if they wanted to. There's Jey Uso. There's Ilya Dragunov. Sami Zayn, I think, should be kept away from Gunther until at least WrestleMania next year. Then they can tell the story of Sami being the man to finally hand Gunther his first main roster loss, right? Which he did at this year's WrestleMania. And at the same time, trying to finally win his first world championship. Right? That's the story for those two. That's not a story you tell now. That's a story I think you wait until next year. You tell it then. So that is the card. I don't expect any more matches to be added. Triple H has kept these international shows to five matches. We have our five. Maybe they throw something on the pre-show, but I'm not expecting it. I think whatever they have in mind, they're going to do on SmackDown this upcoming week. They've already announced a women's championship match for SmackDown with Nia Jax and Meechan. It's going to be a street fight. I mentioned the LA Knight Open Challenge. One more note. Roman Reigns had been advertised for SmackDown's USA Network debut on September 13. That was the next show he was advertised for. He is no longer listed for that show on WWE.com in the list of talents that are slated for that SmackDown. Now, he is still listed, last I checked, on the website for the arena in Seattle where the show is being held, the Climate Pledge Arena. But the WWE listing would be the latest and the most accurate one, and he ain't on there. So that could always change, but as of this moment, it's up in the air if he will be on that show or when we might see him back on TV. Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. When your schedule is packed and you've got work to do, kids to drive to soccer practice, or something that needs fixing for your parents or your in-laws, it can be hard to make time for the things that you really care about. You know, for me, it's that cardio workout at the gym. Sometimes the day gets away from me. I don't get it in. I'm all pissed off because for me, that's non-negotiable. I have to get that in. But sometimes there just aren't enough hours in the day. Even the things that make us happy, it can be tough to make time for them. When you feel like you have no time for yourself, non-negotiables like that, or like therapy, well, they become more important than ever. Therapy can do incredible things for you. It can help you understand yourself better, better understand the things that may be bothering you, identifying ways to try to fix them. It's okay to ask for help. I know some people, you know, for some of them, that's still a taboo thing. The idea of therapy or asking someone for help, you think you can just figure it out on your own. You're fooling yourself. It's okay to admit that you don't always have all the answers. If you're thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. It's designed to be suited to your schedule. Just fill out a short questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and rest easy knowing that you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Never skip a therapy day with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/Solomonster today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Solomonster. Now there is a big anniversary coming up this week. This Monday marks the silver anniversary of SmackDown. 25 years to the day that the show premiered as a weekly series on network television, what was UPN Network at the time. I should note this was not technically the first episode. They aired a pilot episode in April of 1999 that did well enough that they picked it up as a weekly series 4 months later. And WWE, they were hot at the time. I mean, really, it was the peak of their popularity and rating success in the Attitude Era. I mean, they were doing shows on Monday nights that were doing sixes and sevens. And so SmackDown premiered in August of 99, and that was, again, it wasn't cable, so they weren't doing sixes and sevens on there on UPN. But because of just their overall popularity and how hot the product was and wrestling was at the time, SmackDown was born, and here we are now, 25 years later. In celebration of this, I thought I would put together my own personal list of the top 25 matches and moments in SmackDown history. Now, I will tell you, this is not a ranked list. It is a mix of matches and moments. I've narrowed it down to 25. They are in no particular order. They are not in date order. They are not in rank order. I mean, 25 years is a long time. And I just wanted to distill this down to what I think are the 25 best, most memorable, most fun. There may be a few gems that I'm missing. I'm sure there are. If so, you can fill me in on what you would have on your list. But this is my list, not your list. And I'm including the episode dates for those of you who want to look them up on Peacock. I will start here with that very first episode on August 26th, 1999, taped two nights earlier at Kemper Arena in Kansas City, Missouri. This was WWE's first time back in that venue since Owen Hart fell to his death in that building 3 months earlier. It's only 90 days before this. Now, at the time, WCW already had Thursday Night Thunder on TBS. I didn't bother with Thunder. Thunder was basically what AEW Collision is today. It's a show that I check out when I can. I keep up with what's going on, but it's not a priority for me. But when SmackDown debuted on Thursdays, I was there for it. Chris Jericho made his in-ring debut on that show against Road Dogg. But it was the main event that I remember well. It was Triple H defending the WWF title that he had only won on Raw 24 hours earlier, defending against The Rock with Commissioner Shawn Michaels as the special guest referee. It's a very memorable finish. Rock goes for the people's elbow only to come off the ropes and eat a super kick from HBK. Triple H wins. It made me want to see Rock against Shawn Michaels. Watching this, if you were a regular fan just tuning in, you would think that maybe they were building up to it. Nope. I thought that was the plan. I thought, hey, Shawn's going to come back. He's going to get in the ring with The Rock. This is going to be great. We never got Rock against Shawn Michaels. Shawn was still out with the back injury, and Rock had no interest in working with him. He had no love lost for Shawn Michaels at that time. I think they're on better terms now. But back then, it goes all the way back to when Shawn was younger and he worked the territory in Hawaii and apparently was very disrespectful to Rock's grandmother. And Rock never forgot that. I do wonder what the plan was, though, coming out of this, because Shawn had been a babyface. Then he pulled a heel move here and he cost Rock the title and he celebrated with Triple H in China. Whatever their plans may have been, because I'm sure we would have gotten more Shawn on TV, maybe not wrestling, but he would have been a presence on the show. Those plans were scuttled after Shawn went on their Bite This internet show, and he complained about Stone Cold not doing a clean job for Triple H at SummerSlam. That was when they inserted Mankind into the main event, and Mankind won the title. Then Triple H beat Mankind for the belt the next night. He made comments to the effect of, I was hurt going into my match with Austin at WrestleMania, and it would have been nice if I could have had the luxury of having a third man in the ring, too. And how if I was the one in that match at SummerSlam, that shit would have gone down the right way. That shit would have gone down the way it was supposed to go. I don't think he was used on TV after that. Not as much as they had planned to. Similar to when Steve Austin went on Bite This in 2002 and he complained about how poor the creative was. And then magically, a few weeks later, Vince McMahon is telling him, hey, I want you to do a job at a King of the Ring qualifying match on TV to Brock Lesnar. And Austin said, see ya. He walked out. We didn't see him again for another 8 months. 2 weeks later, on the September 9th, 1999 episode of SmackDown, we got what was the first and remains to this day the only buried alive match to ever air on television and not on pay-per-view, with Rock and Mankind defending their tag team titles against The Big Show and The Undertaker. I am a mark for the buried alive stipulation. I don't know why. I just always loved that stip. I have not necessarily loved every buried alive match that I've seen, but I love the first one and I like this one here. I was always hoping they would add it to one of the video games, which I think they eventually did. By that point, I wasn't playing them anymore. But I'm talking like in the early days, or like Warzone and Attitude and maybe the first SmackDown versus Raw, like those games. I was like, man, they got to add a buried alive mode to these games. And I was so pissed they didn't have one. But this is the match that gave us that great gif of Triple H shoveling dirt on Mankind in the grave. Oh, how that gif has come in useful for many a buried meme when it comes to Triple H. It's just too perfect. He wasn't even in the match, but he ended up burying Mankind to give the titles to Undertaker and Big Show. But the absolute best moment of this entire match, or the worst, if you're poor Mick Foley, Big Show and Mankind are on the stage. And, you know, the whole plot of dirt and everything in the grave is off to the side of the stage. And the spot is that Big Show is going to toss Mankind off the stage far enough that he lands right in the open grave. Now, if you watch it back, it's way too far. I don't know what they were thinking. It's way too far. So I don't know how they figured that Foley would even be able to make it. It's not like he was in prime physical condition to begin with. But in one of his books, Foley said that that was the goal. You know, he cleared the distance from the stage to the dirt mound, but he fell short of the open grave. And when he landed on the dirt, he bounced right on his hip. He bounced into the grave. I actually think it made for a better visual. But in the history of crazy Mick Foley bumps, I don't think this one gets talked about enough, right? It may not be the craziest he's ever done, but it's still pretty crazy. It might not be a hole in one, but it made for a great visual. A few weeks later, on September 30th, 1999, The Rock served as the guest referee for a match between Triple H and the British Bulldog. Rock was headed for a match with the Bulldog in No Mercy. He promised to call this match right down the middle, and I guess he did. He gave Triple H a rock bottom, but then he also refused to count three when Bulldog went for the pin. He also ended up blasting Bulldog and Triple H in the head with the belt when Bulldog tried to use it on him. And then came one of the greatest moments in SmackDown history. The sliding people's elbow. In his dress shoes, Rock comes off the ropes and he slides. It had to be a good 3 feet before dropping the elbow on the Bulldog. He looked like the coolest motherfucker in the room. I don't think you can have a credible list of top SmackDown moments and not include the sliding people's elbow. Number 22. And again, these are not ranked. I'm just assigning numbers to them so I can keep track of where I'm at. A couple of months later, WWE pulled off a nice coup by getting Arnold Schwarzenegger to make a guest appearance on the show to promote his new film, End of Days, where Satan visits New York looking for a woman to marry, and Arnold is an ex-cop who has to try to stop him. I'm sorry to say I watched that movie, and I have not watched it again since. But this was the November 11th, 1999 episode of SmackDown. Vince McMahon presented him with a replica version of the Big Eagle belt in the middle of the ring. And Arnold did commentary for the main event, which was an elimination match, since they were trying to get people all hyped up for Survivor Series. After the match, Triple H took a swing at Arnold, who dodged it and then beat the hell out of Triple H. Austin laid out Helmsley and then shared some beers with Arnold in the ring. I remember it like it was yesterday. The fans went nuts when Arnold started raining shots down on Triple H. And then he looked like he was having the time of his life out there. He missed his calling. Arnold could have definitely had a career in wrestling as a wrestler, but just, I feel like any kind of character, he would have fit in perfectly in that world. Number 21, September 11th, 2003. I could not tell you anything else about that episode, but John Cena and Eddie Guerrero had a famous parking lot brawl on that show. That was a lot of fun. They were in the parking garage. They had various cars forming a circle, like a fight pit almost. And they fought in the middle. Cena was rocking the Doctor of Thuganomics gimmick, and this was the first real memorable match of his from that run. Chavo got involved to help out his Uncle Eddie. Eddie finished Cena off with a frog splash off the roof of a car onto Cena, who was laid out on the hood of another car. A fun, memorable brawl. Number 20. Life sucks, and then you die. Those were the famous words of one Vince McMahon on the May 11th, 2000 episode of SmackDown. Back when the McMahon-Helmsley faction was running the show, they were all gathered in the ring for what turned out to be one of the best promos in WWE history. In fact, I had this ranked number 9 on the top 9 promos list that I did many years ago. Vince turned out to be a heel in real life, too, but that Mr. McMahon character is, in my opinion, the greatest heel of all time. This promo and his delivery is one of the reasons. He healed on the fans in the audience that night, said that the same kind of people who would wait in line like sheep, waiting your turn, then you see somebody like him cut in front of the line and you'll say, wait a minute, that's not fair. Then there's the parking lot. There you are, patiently waiting for your parking space. And suddenly it appears. You start driving towards it and then, oops, someone zips in, cuts you off, parks their car, and you say, wait a minute, that's my parking spot. That's not fair. Then he talks about those occasions where you look in the mirror, or as he used to say, the mirror. You look in the mirror, and you women, you see the cellulite hanging from your hips and your butt. That's not fair. And you men, you take a quick peek and you think, that can't be me, with the pot belly and the small genitalia. Oh no, that's not fair. Then he talked about the money. It's all about the money. You scrimp and you save, you work yourselves half to death, and still you can't afford what you really want. That's not fair. It's not fair that some people are rich and you're not. And then, to close things out, talks about how you just have to face the facts that the vast majority of you are born with inferior DNA. And you say, it's not fair that I'm born with inferior DNA. But you feel sorry for yourselves. You wallow in your self-pity. And then there comes a point where you have to face the facts that life is not fair. And you may as well own up to the philosophy for some of you, and that is that life sucks, and then you die. Can't do it quite as good as he did, but that was the gist of it. It was a classic Mr. McMahon promo. And not entirely inaccurate, what he was saying. But that had to be on this list, because it's just such a great promo. And at the very end, when he has that line, you know, the life sucks and then you die, you could see X-Pac is like in the background right behind him. And he's just like, He's nodding his head like, yeah, this was great. Number 19, Gore, Gore, Gore. August 9th, 2001, the end of the original SmackDown set. This was the night that Rhino gored Chris Jericho through the screen and collapsed the set. It was a great visual. It was part of the SmackDown intro for years, the highlights of this. The reason they did it was to make way for a new set that they created. In the following week, we had the debut of the SmackDown Fist, just sitting in a warehouse somewhere, and Marilyn Manson's The Beautiful People as the new theme song for SmackDown. Number 18. Never in the history of this company has someone had the rocket strapped to them as quickly and as impressively as Brock Lesnar did in 2002. He debuted on television in April. He won the King of the Ring in June, and in the span of 60 days, from June to August, Vince McMahon wanted to put Brock over Steve Austin, Hulk Hogan, and The Rock. Like, legitimately the three biggest names in the history of this company. Two of those matches being on television, not even on pay-per-view. Austin walked out rather than do the job for Brock in a King of the Ring qualifier. Brock pinned Rock to win the title at SummerSlam. But in between, it was the week before SummerSlam that Lesnar put his number one contendership on the line in a match on the August 8th, 2002 episode of SmackDown against Hulk Hogan. The match itself, nothing special, but it was an attraction. Hogan Andre, WrestleMania 3. How is it as a match, right? As a match? Nothing terribly special. But, you know, the slam heard round the world is still the most iconic moment in the history of this company. So sometimes it's just about what you feel, right? It feels like a big deal. It feels like a big match. This felt like a big match. It was definitely an attraction. The past against the present. or the future. Kind of monster heel that Hogan would have loved to work with in his heyday and of course would have beaten. But those days were over. The goal here was to put Lesnar over strong heading into SummerSlam. He got to kick out of the leg drop. He hit an F5. But instead of pinning him, he locked Hogan in a bear hug. And Hogan went out, blood pouring from his mouth from internal injuries. Lesnar wins by ref stoppage. That was a shocking way for Hogan to lose even then. But then we got the visual of Lesnar rubbing Hogan's blood across his own chest. He looked like an animal. It looked like something animalistic that you would see, you know, in the woods. If you were hiding behind a tree and you were watching predators go at it, this is the sort of thing that you would see. This was the moment where you knew they had big plans for Brock Lesnar. After that, Hogan and Vince, they had a falling out again. He pulled himself off the Australian tour that he was advertised for. And as the story goes, he wanted to also get his win back on Brock at Survivor Series at Madison Square Garden and win the belt. But that would have been ridiculous. Thankfully, that did not happen. Although he did come back in January. Number 17 is Edge, cashing in his Money in the Bank briefcase on The Undertaker to win the World Heavyweight Championship on the May 11th, 2007 episode of SmackDown. How we got here was a bunch of people got hurt. Plain and simple. Undertaker had just won the world title from Batista at WrestleMania. He was supposed to have a long run with the belt, possibly the rest of the year. This is when Undertaker, I mean, my God, he had gotten himself into the best shape of his career. This was Undertaker at his physical peak, like Undertaker in his final form. He was in better shape here than he was in the 90s. And then he tore his bicep tendon, and he needed surgery, and it was going to keep him out for a number of months. Meanwhile, Mr. Kennedy had just won Money in the Bank at WrestleMania, and he announced that he was going to wait and cash in at next year's WrestleMania, which was legitimately the plan until The Undertaker got hurt. Then the plan was to have Kennedy cash in early, until Kennedy got hurt with what was initially diagnosed as a triceps tear, which would have kept him on the shelf for 6 months. So they panicked, and they very hastily booked a match on Raw where Kennedy agreed to put his briefcase on the line against Edge. Edge beat him for the briefcase. Edge then was shifted from Raw to SmackDown, and he won the world championship from The Undertaker. His second Money in the Bank cash-in. Only to then find out that Kennedy was misdiagnosed and his triceps tendon was not torn off the bone like they thought. And he was back in a matter of weeks. But the damage was done. They already took the briefcase from him and he never recovered from that. You know, that man would have been world champion. And his career might have turned out very different. But things happen. And things go a different way. And it's amazing, you know, sometimes you hit that fork in the road, you can go left or right. It looks like you're going to go right. Shit happens. You go left, and that's just the way it goes. So what happened instead? Undertaker wrestled a 30-minute cage match with Batista on SmackDown with his arm wrapped. Won what I remember being actually a very good match. Then he got attacked by Mark Henry, and then Edge, as Henry was leaving, Edge comes out with another referee, swoops in, wins the title. This was the beginning of the Edge era on SmackDown. That was his show there for a couple years, at least a couple years. And it was the best thing that could have happened to him because it allowed him to get away from Raw and make SmackDown his show, which he never would have been able to do on the other show with, you know, people like John Cena and Triple H. So even the effects that it had on Edge's career, it's amazing how everything is connected. Either Undertaker goes on to have a long run as the World Heavyweight Champion, Kennedy holds on to the briefcase until the following year like he promised to, and who knows where Edge ends up. Or Kennedy does cash in, and same thing, where does Edge end up? But then you see the way it played out, it worked out for Edge, not so much for Kennedy. Number 16, the Big Boss Man. The Big Boss Man, in 1999, he was just a different kind of heel. One of the most irredeemable pieces of shit to ever grace the wrestling ring. The way that this man tortured poor Al Snow and Big Show that year. It truly is one of the great despicable heel runs of all time. I don't care what anybody says. And there's two segments from SmackDown that year. I'm going to lump them together here in one spot. The first being the segment where he fed Al Snow's dog to him. Telling you, man, the Attitude Era was wild. Bossman had been feuding with Al over the Hardcore title, and he had dog-napped his little chihuahua, Pepper. And Al just wanted his dog back. So when Bossman invited him to his hotel room, it was the September 2nd, 1999 episode, he thought he was getting Pepper back. What he got was some Pepper steak. Bossman prepared a meal for him and promised, just have the food, enjoy the food. It's like him trying to like say I'm sorry, basically. And if you have the food, I promise I'll give you the dog back. So Al starts to eat, and he's asking him, how's it taste? Don't get one of those paws stuck in between your teeth. Then Al realized he was eating his own dog. And he starts puking all over the place. Bossman beats him senseless with his nightstick. And then Bossman took a bite, and he said, tastes like chicken. The look on Jerry Lawler's face when they cut back to the arena, his eyes were just damn near bugging out of his head. Feeding the man's dog to him. In the history of heel moves, I would say that ranks pretty high up there. I don't know how you get any worse than that. But somehow, arguably, he managed to, because that brings us to the Arnold Schwarzenegger episode on November 11th. Bossman had moved on from Al Snow. Now he was feuding with the Big Show. They created a storyline where Big Show's father had passed away. Now, I think in real life, his father was already dead. Bossman absolutely tormented this man. He even broke into his mother's house, and on live television, he forced Big Show's mom to reveal that Show was a bastard child. But the coup de grace of this all was his father's funeral. As Bruce Pritchard tells the story, this was Big Show's idea. He credits Big Show for the idea. They shot this at a cemetery in Connecticut. There was a real funeral service that was going on nearby, and they were warned, okay, we'll let you use the cemetery for your shoot, although there's no fucking way they knew what these guys were planning on doing. But they agreed, okay, you can use it, but just don't be disruptive, and please don't tear up the grounds, right? I mean, these are grave sites here. They failed on both. Bossman shows up in the middle of the ceremony as they're, you know, paying tribute to Big Show's father, and the casket is there, and the family members are mourning, and Big Show's wearing leather pants, because who among us does not wear leather pants to their father's funeral? And here comes the big boss man, driving through the cemetery in the old Blues Brothers car with a giant speaker on top, shouting that he's glad the old bastard is dead. Big Show goes after him. He starts climbing onto the hood of the car. Boss man puts the car in reverse, and Big Show falls to the ground. All the family members rush over to check on poor Big Show. Meanwhile, Bossman goes over. He chains the casket with Big Show's dead father inside to the back of the car, and he begins to drive off, dragging the casket behind him, and in the process, tearing the shit out of the ground. Big Show dives onto the casket as it's being dragged. He's riding it like a sled. It's like he's surfing. He's body surfing on top of the casket. Until he fell over, he took this amazing slow motion bump where he did a complete flip on his head. Like, it was the tree bump. That's what it is. You saw the match between Shawn Michaels and Psycho Sid at Survivor Series that year? It's the tree bump. That's what Big Show did. Just an amazing scene and an absolutely terrible thing to do in someone's final resting place, as a cemetery is. But Bruce, always the courageous one, said that he hightailed it out of there once they got what they needed, and he left the production assistant to deal with the fallout. And they were banned from ever using that cemetery ever again after that. I can't imagine why. Number 15, John Cena's debut on the June 27th, 2002 episode, for historical purposes, if nothing else. This has to be on the list. And it was a memorable segment. Kurt Angle was out there. He issued an open challenge to any talent in the back that he never wrestled before. And out comes John Cena. And I will admit, I'm one of these people. I know Santino said it for comedy for many years on TV, but when I first saw this man's name spelled out, whatever newsletter or website it would have been back then that I saw his name on, I saw John Cena. I didn't read it as John Cena for whatever reason. For whatever reason, I read it as John Cena. So until they spoke it on TV, I'm thinking this guy's name is John Cena. Of course, now I look back, I feel like a fucking idiot, but I didn't know. I mean, you know, I didn't know this guy from a hole in the wall. How the hell am I supposed to know? So out comes John Cena to answer the challenge, looking like a generic, just prototype straight out of a creator wrestler mode. Kurt asks him, "What makes you think that you can hang with me?" And Cena says, "Ruthless aggression," which is what Vince McMahon, the phrase that he had coined, I think it was maybe that week on TV. It was on Raw when he had the whole roster around the ring. He says, "I'm looking for ruthless aggression," right? So he says ruthless aggression. He smacks the shit out of Kurt, and we were off to the races. And they, you know, they had a very basic 5-minute match. Kurt pinned him. But this was our introduction to John Cena on television. And there was still a moment months later where he was this close from being released. He was going to get cut until Stephanie McMahon happened to be riding on the same tour bus, wherever they were. They might have been on an international tour, maybe. Stephanie's in the front of the bus and she hears him rapping because I guess a lot of the guys were like freestyling. So he got in on it. He goes, "I can do that." Stephanie overhears this and the rest is history. Saved his job. Think of where John Cena is today. Big star in Hollywood. Does any of this happen? If not for that moment. It's one of those things in life you can never say yes or no absolutely, right? Maybe he still would have ended up being a big star. Maybe he would have gotten cut, but they would have rehired him later on and he would have been a champion anyway. Maybe his life would have taken him down a very different path, right? Who knows? But it was the moment with Angle here that started it all. And now here we are. This man's about to have his retirement tour. And they call him the greatest of all time every time we see him on TV. Number 14, The Shield. The Shield was unbeatable for the first half of 2013. I love The Shield. Roman Reigns, Seth Rollins, and Dean Ambrose. They were pushed to the moon from the moment they stepped onto the scene at Survivor Series the year before. So it felt like a big deal when they finally lost on the June 14th, 2013 episode of SmackDown. It was Randy Orton, Daniel Bryan, and Kane against Reigns, Rollins, and Ambrose. Orton put Rollins down with an RKO, and then Bryan tapped him out in the Yes Lock, and the fans lost their minds. They were so happy to finally see these men lose. It was the go-home show to Payback that Sunday. Roman and Seth, they beat Bryan and Orton, so they got their win back. But the Shield's first loss, that was a big deal. And I love that run. I love the Shield run. One of the greatest groups ever assembled was the Shield. Number 13, Shawn Michaels and Kurt Angle. They had one of the greatest matches in WrestleMania history. Bobby the Brain Heenan told friends of his that he thought it was the greatest wrestling match he had ever seen. So much so that he reached out to Howard Finkel to get their phone numbers so he could call them up personally and let them know. And then when he talked to Kurt, he played a rib on him by asking if he can get him a job in the company. But for Bobby Heenan to tell you that it was the greatest match he ever saw, better than any Ray Stevens match, Nick Bockwinkel match, any of the great stars that he himself managed, Andre, Perfect, I mean, Flair, think of all the matches that this man was a part of, let alone must have seen in his life. I can think of no greater compliment than that. And in the lead up to that match, Kurt was out to show that anything Shawn could do, he could do better. He went back into the past and he wrestled Marty Jannetty on SmackDown. But that's not the moment I have on my list here. What he also did was on the March 24th, 2005 episode, he came to the ring dressed like Shawn Michaels, out to Shawn Michaels' music. And he even brought out with him Shawn's old manager, Sensational Sherry. This is where we got the rendition, the classic rendition, the legendary rendition of Sexy Kurt. I'll Make Your Ankle Hurt. A classic moment and a song that is still stuck in my head almost 20 years later. Kurt could do it all, man. Kurt Angle could do it all. He could go from goofy comedy like this to a week later tapping out Shawn Michaels in a totally serious wrestling match, looking like an absolute killer. Just the way he was able to flip the switch like that, it's why he's one of the absolute goats. Number 12. There have been a lot of great bloodline segments on SmackDown over the past few years. The Tribal Court segment from Madison Square Garden last year being one of the very best. And I struggled with which one to feature here, but I just can't rank it above the Usy segment from the October 28th, 2022 episode of SmackDown. Roman Reigns wanted the bloodline to hash out their differences. Specifically, he was talking about Sami Zayn and Jey Uso, who did not like Sami Zayn. For many, many months, he was vehemently against Sami Zayn being brought into the family, being brought into the bloodline. He didn't agree with it. He didn't trust him. He didn't like him. The other thing is, Sami had made it his mission to make as many members of the bloodline crack up on live TV as he possibly could every single week, whether it was in the ring, whether it was in a backstage segment. And so here, it finally came to a head. And the two of them are arguing, and Roman is, again, the way that this was like positioned and shot was just so perfect, because Roman is standing in front of them. They're behind him, and they're arguing like a couple of kids. And then we hear Jey Uso, who had a short fuse. Of course, this is a totally different Jey Uso that we see today. The Jey Uso we see today is almost too goofy. You know, everything is yeet, and he's out there, and he's happy-go-lucky. But back then, you know, part of his character was that he had a short fuse. He was in a foul mood most of the time when we saw him. And he could go off on you at any moment. And he went off here. He says, I don't give a damn what the tribal chief says. Because Sammy was trying to tell him, look, the tribal chief said, he goes, I don't give a damn what the tribal chief says. And then Roman's head just snaps up. And he's looking directly ahead into the hard cam. They zoom in on his face and he looks pissed. And everybody in the crowd realizes, okay, you done fucked up. And so then he goes over to, you know, to talk to Jey, and Sammy is standing there, and Sammy is trying to defuse the situation. He says, Roman, he didn't mean that. He's trying to calm things down here. And he says that Jey isn't feeling very Usy. That was it. It all broke down after that. Jey Uso is standing in the middle of the ring. He's not even by the ropes. He can't like hold on to anything. It's like you could hold on to the rope, or like if you were, you know, there's like a banister or something, just like grab onto it, and he can't do anything. He's standing there. He's got nowhere to go. It's the theater in the round, right? No matter which way you look, you can't hide your face. He's burying his face in his hands. He's trying so hard not to crack up laughing. He is fighting for his life in the middle of this ring, and there is nowhere to hide. And it was to the point where, you know, the Usy line just came out of nowhere. I don't even think it was planned. It happens. And even in the background, like, you can see Paul Heyman is struggling a little bit, and Jimmy is in the corner, and he's at least able to hide it kind of a little bit. Solo Sikoa, to his credit, is stoic the entire time. His expression never changed. Solo, I mean, his poker face is perfect. So it didn't really have any effect on him. Even Roman was struggling not to crack up laughing. And Roman said, look, I'm going to take away the honorary on Sammy's t-shirt. He's not going to be the honorary Uso anymore. He's going to name him Sammy Uso. And then we got the zoom in on Sammy's face, which is so wholesome. And it was so perfect. But poor Jey Uso, man. I mean, it was just, what do you do? Look, I get the giggles sometimes. It's impossible. You can't stop it. It's just nothing you can do. You just have to let it play through. There's nothing that you can do. There's absolutely nothing that you can do. But it made for very entertaining television. This is still my favorite of all the Bloodline segments, right? There have been some great ones. None better than this one, though. This has to be in the top 25. I might even have this in my top 10. I don't know, but it's definitely in the top 25. Number 11, November 15th, 2001. 3 days before Team WWF wrestled the Alliance at Survivor Series, and the Invasion storyline came to an end, thankfully. As bungled as that Invasion story was, it gave us one of the all-time great segments in SmackDown history. Paul Heyman's worked shoot, his worked shoot promo on Vince McMahon. The pipe bomb, long before CM Punk dropped one of his own. According to Heyman, Vince did not want to know what he was going to say. So he had no idea what was coming. And he even told Heyman, I'm not even going to respond to you. Like, I'm going to come out in the middle of the segment. You'll continue your promo. I will stand there and you'll just give it to me. And I won't say a word. He said, just go out there and draw me money. It's the go-home show. Just draw me money. It was the kind of promo that probably did sell a lot of pay-per-views, so it accomplished that goal. The way that Heyman managed to blend reality and storyline was masterful. He says, you know, I've waited so long to tell you to your face that I hate your guts. He called Vince the most disgusting, vile human being. Who knew how right he was? He said that he used Hulk Hogan's blood to build Titan Towers. He stole Bret Hart's dream and made himself a nice big plane with, you know, he got himself a nice plane with WWF plastered all over it. And he stole Shawn Michaels' smile and made himself a billionaire, all these things. He said Vince's dad, he knew Vince's father. Vince's father is the one that allowed him or was paying him to take photographs in Madison Square Garden back in the day. So he said, Vince's dad, he promised the other promoters that he wouldn't compete. And then when he died, you competed. And you put all the promoters out of business. You stole my ideas and branded it attitude. And he told Vince, he goes, you got nothing. What you've got are my ideas. You stole my life, my money, my legacy. And he threw his hat at him. Said, screw you and your family. I'll tell you something, your own children hate your guts. And on Sunday, your children are going to get even with you for everything you stole from me, for everything that you stole from them. You flaunt your affairs in front of your wife. You flaunt your affairs in Playboy for your children to read. And he told them, you make wrestling a dirty word. He even healed on Taz. Taz was out there doing color at the time with Michael Cole. He pointed over at Taz. He goes, look at Taz. This man was a killer. He was, you know, whatever. He was respected. He was a killer. And now he's a fat, little, obnoxious color commentator and not even a good one. And that was Taz's cue to get in the ring. Now, Taz didn't actually know what the cue was. All Heyman says is you'll know it when it comes. And so Taz got up. He got into the ring. And he choked out Heyman with a very stiff Tazmission. It's worth watching the entire thing because, again, I'm just paraphrasing parts of it. But that is how you sell a pay-per-view. Then Heyman was fired on TV the following Monday. And then the next time we saw him after that, he was with some new guy named Brock Lesnar. Number 10, Edge and Christian, the Hardys. And the Dudleys, they innovated the tables, ladders, and chairs match. Their best one, in my opinion, TLC 2, the WrestleMania X7. The very next month, they were asked to do it again, but this time with an extra team involved. That gave us TLC 3 on the May 24th, 2001 episode of SmackDown, a match that these men only had 5 hours to put together on short notice. Matt Hardy said that Vince McMahon told them it's very important that they get Chris Jericho and Chris Benoit over that night, especially with Triple H going down with his quad injury the night before on Raw. Because remember, this was taped the night after it aired 2 days later, but it was the night before that Triple H tore his quad for the first time, finished the match, and Jericho and Benoit won the titles, which was the plan, but whatever they had planned for the follow-up the next night was blown to smithereens. Suddenly, they were being asked to pull another TLC match out of their asses like it was nothing. And it was a great match, but it ended up being significant for another reason. There was a spot in the match where Chris Benoit did his signature diving headbutt off the top through a table on the floor, which is very stupid, by the way. Through a table on the floor, Matt Hardy was laid out across the table. He rolled off, and Benoit went through the table headfirst. So he got carted out to the back, which was planned, came back out later on. He won the match for his team, but he really did get hurt on that headbutt spot. He just didn't realize it, or at least realize how serious it was. That's the bump that caused the neck injury that he would later need fusion surgery for. You know, and I know on TV they credited the injury to the match at the King of the Ring. It didn't happen there. It happened in this match. And he continued to wrestle for weeks until the King of the Ring pay-per-view, where they needed him in the main event. It was a triple threat match with Stone Cold defending the title against Chris Jericho and Chris Benoit. If you thought that Triple H beating Booker T at WrestleMania with one pedigree was bad, that it took forever for him to crawl over to make the cover, you got to see the ending of this match. Benoit gives Jericho a back suplex from the top, and the match didn't even have that much heat. Benoit gives Jericho a back suplex from the top rope, lands on the back of his own neck. All three men are down. Benoit's clutching the back of his head, moving around, and now he's laying prone on the mat. Jericho's down, Austin's down, prone. And no joke, it was 40 seconds, which may not sound to some people like a lot of time, but in this situation, it's a lot of time. 40 seconds go by before Austin slow crawls over, covers Benoit, hooks the leg, and pins him. That was the finish of the match. Very anticlimactic, but the word was that Benoit may have legitimately had numbness in his limbs after the bump. I'm not saying he didn't get hurt or more hurt after the bump. I'm just saying they always credited this match as where it happened, and that's just not true because he came into the match very, very much injured. But again, it didn't look like they called an audible or anything like that. It looked like that was the planned finish. That was the same match where Booker T came out when he debuted. He put Austin through the announce desk, which broke Austin's hand, and it really messed up his back pretty badly. So it was like the walking wounded in there. But they had to know that this was going to be Benoit's final night before he went off to have surgery. Benoit, man, you know, he was a machine back then. The night before, he and Jericho won the tag team titles from Austin and Triple H, which is one of the greatest matches in Raw history that doesn't get talked about anymore for all the obvious reasons. The night before that, they had their Judgment Day pay-per-view. He wrestled Kurt Angle in a best 2 out of 3 falls match, one of those falls being a ladder match. So that's a 20-minute plus match. Later on, he comes back out on the same show. He and Jericho win a tag team turmoil match to become number one contenders. Then the next night, they win the titles in that great match. The night after that at the SmackDown tapings is where they do TLC 3, and he hurts his neck. The week after that, he worked back-to-back main events against Stone Cold Steve Austin for the title, one on Raw and then again on SmackDown the next night. This man had a broken neck and did not slow down. And not only did he not slow down, but it did not diminish the quality of the matches that he had. That's what's crazy. Number 9, Edge and Seth Rollins. They had a great trilogy of matches back in 2021. Their first being at SummerSlam, their last match being inside Hell in a Cell in Saudi Arabia. In between, though, was their second match on the September 10th, 2021 episode of SmackDown from Madison Square Garden. They went nearly 25 minutes. Rollins picked up the win. It was a fantastic match. So at that point, they were all even at one win apiece going into the Cell, which was also an excellent match. I thought the entire trilogy was great. But this is one of the best matches in SmackDown history. Number 8. The early days of the brand split were great because it's the closest to a true battle of the brands that we really ever had, even in the years since, before it devolved into not mattering. The Billy and Chuck wedding on the September 12th, 2002 episode is a great example of this. Billy Gunn and Chuck Palumbo, for those who don't know, they were managed by Rico at the time, Rico Constantino. And he was doing, at this point, he started doing a gimmick. It was like he was their hairstylist, their fashion consultant, whatever you want to call it. And the two of them were very affectionate for each other. They started playing basically two gay men who were about to get married on TV. Or that's what we were supposed to think anyway. How progressive of WWE. So progressive, they even got GLAAD involved. The Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation. who they consulted with on the storyline. They actually helped WWE get mainstream publicity for the angle because they really thought that they were going to have or portray a gay wedding on TV. So imagine their surprise when they saw the angle play out with both men stopping the ceremony before it got too far to reveal that they, in fact, were not gay. Not that they have any problem with that, of course, but it was all just supposed to be a publicity stunt. And they said, "Rico, what are you doing, man? This has gone too far." Glad was not happy about this. And frankly, they had every right to be upset. I mean, WWE blatantly used them and duped them into gaining media attention for what they thought was going to be a gay marriage and turned out to be two giant Samoans running out to beat the crap out of them and a woman. That was Jamal and Rosie, who laid out Stephanie McMahon with a Samoan drop. Stephanie was the SmackDown general manager at the time. See, this is what I loved about the angle. It was the swerve. It was so well done. Stephanie was in the ring for the ceremony, but so was the minister presiding over the ceremony. That minister, the old man in the ring, turned out to be Eric Bischoff, who at the time was the Raw general manager. That reveal when Bischoff's voice changes from the old man voice to his voice, and he starts ripping off and peeling off all the prosthetic makeup on his face, that was tremendous. Absolutely tremendous. This was Bischoff's single greatest piece of work that he did in the time he spent in WWE. Of all the segments that he was a part of, and he was a great GM, this right here, this was the best. I legitimately had no idea that it was him. And then 3-minute warning hits the ring. Again, a couple of Raw guys. It was like a little mini invasion. Stephanie gets laid out. Here comes the rest of the roster to chase them off. It was great television when the brand split felt like it really mattered and there was real competition between the two shows. Number 7. On the February 8th, 2016 episode of Raw, Daniel Bryan stood in the middle of the ring and he announced his retirement from pro wrestling. And it was a very emotional speech, as you would imagine, and not unlike the speech that Edge gave many years earlier when he retired. Yeah, but if you're Daniel Bryan, 2016, you know, you're not that far removed from 2014, which was the peak for him. And to go from the highest of highs in his career to the end of his career, I mean, you could just see it in his eyes. It was devastating. 2 years later, on the March 20th, 2018 episode of SmackDown, Daniel Bryan again stood in the middle of the ring, but this time to announce that he had finally been medically cleared to return to the ring and resume his career. And this was only 3 weeks before WrestleMania. It was a wonderful moment. You could see the joy in his eyes. You could see just how happy the fans were to have him back. And what he went through for the 2 years in between, trying to get cleared, going to every doctor, every specialist, taking every test imaginable, it finally paid off. Now, he was going to wrestle anyway. If WWE was not going to clear him, he was already talking like, yeah, when my deal's up, I mean, I'm the GM, and you know, they had him doing different things, and he was getting paid well, but he was as good as gone. There was no way he was going to stay if they weren't going to let him wrestle, because he wanted to go wrestle in Japan and Mexico and you know, just do what he wanted to do, and I think they knew that, and so finally they relented and said, okay, all the tests say that you're cleared, we'll let you back in the ring. And then he did leave, ultimately. 3 years later, he left. And now this weekend, he's wrestling for the World Championship in the main event at Wembley Stadium. Number 6. Again, not a ranked list. I'm just using this to keep track of these things. The September 26th, 2002 episode of SmackDown featured an excellent match pitting Edge, who was first starting to really take off as a single star, against Eddie Guerrero in a no disqualification match. Edge and Eddie were two members of the so-called SmackDown Six that helped carry that show under Paul Heyman when he was the head writer, the other four being Chavo Guerrero, Rey Mysterio, Kurt Angle, and Chris Benoit. That was the SmackDown Six. Days earlier, Eddie had beaten Edge at Unforgiven, so this was the rematch, which Edge won. Great stuff from these two. One of the matches from those early days that still stands out to me. and was a star-making performance for Edge coming off that great program he had earlier that year with Kurt Angle. It really felt like he was ready to break out. And then he was out for over a year after fusion surgery on his neck, stemming from an injury that he sustained in this match when Eddie slammed him on top of a ladder and then frog splashed him on top of the ladder. He had trouble feeling his arms after that, wrestled a few more months. It's not like he was immediately out of the ring. However many more months it was, I think he continued to wrestle until like January or February. But it's amazing, you know, all those TLC matches, and this is the match that broke the camel's back. So he didn't even make it to WrestleMania that year. He went out, he had the surgery. That surgery is also what forced him into an early retirement in 2011, because once you have that fusion done, as Steve Austin found out, you are on borrowed time. Number five, you know, the cost of living, man, it seems to go up every single year. Groceries are still very expensive. But Stone Cold Steve Austin, he doesn't give a shit about your grocery prices. At least he didn't on the December 13th, 2001 episode of SmackDown when he beat the living shit out of Booker T in a supermarket and used all the food he could get his hands on. It didn't matter what it was. I mean, there were nuts and there was cookies and flour and milk. They ended up doing about $10,000 worth of damage. I think they paid the place $20,000 between that and all the food they wasted. I cracked up right from the beginning of this when Booker, he starts eating cereal out of the cereal box. He's like, oh, I just got to check and make sure it's fresh. All right, we got a Grey Poupon reference from Steve Austin. For those who remember those commercials. He threw flour all over Booker and turned him into a white guy. The price check on Jackass line at the end as he's leaving the store was perfect. Everything about this, I love this. It was fun. You know, wrestling is best when it is just fun. This was fun. And this was one of the all-time great segments in the history of the show. This is a segment that I feel like is timeless. You know, because it worked back then. But if you were to air that on TV today, if you were to air this on TV 25 years from now, I still think you would have people laughing their ass off, just thoroughly entertained. It is timeless. Number four, the best match, bell to bell, in SmackDown history is the 60-minute Iron Man match from the September 18th, 2003 episode for the WWE Championship between Brock Lesnar and Kurt Angle, which turned out to be their final singles match in WWE. Brock beat Kurt at WrestleMania. Angle tapped him out at SummerSlam, came into the match as the defending champion. From the very first fall, it was smart on Lesnar's part. He used a chair, even though it got him disqualified and it put Kurt up 1-0. He beat the hell out of him with that chair and ended up picking up the next three falls. By the time the match was over, it was 5-4 in favor of Brock. Kurt had him in the ankle lock. He almost tied it up. They almost went to sudden death. The time expired. Well, I mean, they were on UPN. Can't have sudden death on UPN. You got to go to the local newscast. So he won 5-4. Lesnar won the belt back. It's not my favorite Iron Man match of all time, actually. And it being the first one to air on TV, the commercials definitely hurt the match. It hurt the flow of the match because there were so many of them. But this was still great stuff. And even crazier when you consider that Kurt's sister died of a heroin overdose the day before this match. And he was an absolute wreck. But he hid the pain. And he still went out there. And not only did he go out there and work. You know, it's one thing to go, I got to go back to work the next day. He went to work and had one of the best matches of his life. This wasn't just an ordinary match. He had to go 60 minutes with Brock Lesnar. And they tore it up. Number three, this is the best ending to a SmackDown episode ever. So if you're wondering, Solomonster, what's the best closing segment in 25 years of SmackDown? Here it is. Took place on the same November 15, 2001 episode as Paul Heyman's work shoot on Vince. This was the go-home show to Survivor Series. It was the closing moments to build to Team WWF against the Alliance. It was The Rock and Chris Jericho against Steve Austin and Kurt Angle. It's not that we haven't seen finishes like this since, where everybody runs in and hits their move, but it's never been done better than this, or with as much star power. So many legends and Hall of Famers in the ring for this. This was in the waning days of the Attitude Era. Angle and Austin, they were about to Pillmanize Rock's leg when Undertaker ran in, and he chokeslammed Steve Austin. He tried to do the same thing to Kurt Angle. Booker T ran in, though, with a super kick, and then Kurt hit an angle slam on Undertaker. Jericho gets back in the ring, takes out Booker, clotheslines Angle out over the top, lion salt to Booker, gets up, here's RVD, nearly takes Jericho's head off with a spin kick. Up to the top, five-star frog splash. Here comes Kane, huge choke slam to RVD. Here comes Shane McMahon with a leaping chair shot to Kane's head. He just kind of bopped him right on the head with it. But here's the Big Show. He punches the chair back into Shane's face. Angle slides back into the ring, gets the big fucker up for an angle slam, and The Undertaker, with great ring awareness at all times, I'll never forget this, he's still laying in the corner, selling the angle slam, but he sees there is a chair laying on the mat in the spot where Big Show is probably going to land. So he sticks his leg out and moves the chair out of the way, like a pro. Down goes Big Show. Now The Rock is back in the ring. Rock bottom to Angle. But then Rock turns around, walks right into a stone cold stunner. And with Jim Ross screaming his head off on commentary, there's bodies everywhere. And the only man left standing is the champion. The best ending ever. I go back and I watch this periodically. It never gets old. Number two. The single moment I always think of. So not ending, but the single moment I always think of first when I think of SmackDown happened on the June 12th, 2003 episode. It was the ring collapse with Brock Lesnar and The Big Show. I think SmackDown, I think ring collapse. The two go hand in hand. And Taz on commentary dropping a holy shit that got bleeped out. Brock and Big Show, they were having a match when they went to the top. And Lesnar took him all the way down with a giant superplex that imploded the ring. We've seen them recycle this stunt a few times since. It never hits the same way. It's never been as good. It never will be. You can't top the original. I love to go back and look at the crowd whenever I go back to watch this, just to see their reactions. Like, these people are losing their shit. Because we had never seen anything like this before. The closest thing was in the movie No Holds Barred. Who the fuck saw that except my dumbass? In the movie No Holds Barred, when Hogan kills Zeus at the end, he knocks him off. They were like on the second level. And Zeus falls all the way down backwards into the ring, and the ring implodes on him. But we had never seen this on television before. Like on an actual wrestling show. And Mike Chioda was the referee for this match. His sell job, I mean, when the ring collapses and he falls down, like, it was perfect. And he had to sell it because Brock and Big Show, they were both down and out. Right? There was no more selling that they could do. So his facial expression was the first thing that we saw. And he said, like, he had the people in the back, Vince and whoever else, probably Vince. But Vince and Michael Hayes and everybody in his ear going crazy, like, yes, yes, that's what we want. That's perfect. The only goofy thing about it was the fact that Lesnar and Big Show had to play dead. Like, it was a superplex, dude. I get that they're big guys, but still, it was a superplex. We see this every single week. And they had medics in the ring. They're all huddled around them. They had oxygen. They haven't moved. It's been 5 minutes. Like, it was just way over the top. But the actual ring collapse, like, you can only do it the first time, one time. And this was it. And it could not have come off any better than the way they did it. This was tremendous. And lastly, it's a sad moment, but a beautiful moment. From the first show that they did after the terrorist attacks on 9/11, it was 2 days later on September 13th, 2001, that SmackDown came to Houston, Texas. They were supposed to tape on 9/11. But that got canceled, as everything else did, all sports, everything. Planes were grounded. You couldn't travel anyway. I remember exactly where I was that day when the towers fell. I was in my dorm room getting ready to go to class. I went to class, but when I got there, my English teacher told us, you know, class is canceled because how the hell can you think of anything other than what was going on in that moment? It was just a very surreal day. Wrestling was not the priority, but wrestling was still an escape for a lot of people, and so they made the decision to go live 2 days later. Vince McMahon came out, he gave his speech. All the members of the roster stood on the ramp and on the stage, but it was Lillian Garcia's rendition of the national anthem that, even now, to this day, like, it brings tears to my eyes. Just so well done and so beautifully done for such an ugly moment in our history. I don't remember much else about that show. I know Kurt Angle wrestled Rhino in the main event. I legit do not remember anything else that happened that night. I will always remember that. And those are your 25 best matches and moments in SmackDown history on this, the 25th anniversary. I hope you enjoyed it. It's been a while since I've done one of these lists. Let me know what you think of the list and what your favorite SmackDown moments are. And while you do that, I got some mailbag questions to get through here, and then we'll get on out of here. You can email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from. I got a few questions about this. I plucked out Daniels. Daniel, in Rincon, Georgia, what are your thoughts on the TMZ video of Hulk Hogan promoting his new beer and making racist comments about Kamala Harris? So I saw the video. He was at a club promoting his new beer. He said what he said. He brought up her being Indian and did the how gesture that people use to make fun of Native Americans. And he knew it was stupid because he immediately followed it up with, I'm going to get heat for that one. Then he tried to blame it on the beers. You don't have to blame it on the beers. He's just a racist piece of shit. But it's not like we didn't already know this. He is literally on tape. Okay, and I'm not even talking about the leaked Gawker tape. I'm going back even before that. You know, people seem to forget. Those weren't the only racist remarks that he made about black people. When his son was sitting in prison and Hogan was on the phone with him, they got him on tape saying that the two of them are going to live forever. And he only hopes that they don't get reincarnated as a couple of black guys. Or as he called them, Blizzak Gizzies, because he loves to speak carny, like people aren't going to hear it and know what the fuck he's talking about. I lost all respect for the man after the John Graziano thing. And I think it's worth reminding people from time to time about that whole ordeal. Hogan's son Nick, another winner, was drag racing and he got in a horrible wreck. Okay, he made it out fine. His friend in the passenger seat was not so lucky. He ended up in a vegetative state with brain damage. And to this day, this kid can't walk, he can't talk, he has to be cared for 24/7 by his mother. That family has been through hell. Okay, they lost their other son in a car wreck. He was in the passenger seat, just like John was. And whoever was driving the car was drunk, and they slammed into the back of a dump truck. Of course, the drunk driver survived, because that's how it always seems to work. But that family has been through hell. But they have Hulk and his son on jailhouse recordings where Nick is saying, oh, John was just, he was such a negative person. And Hogan says, oh, man, I don't know what type of person John was to get himself in a situation like that. God laid some serious shit on that kid. Man, I don't know what he was into. So it was Nick's friend's fault. It was John's fault for ending up paralyzed, unable to feed himself. Not his fucking piece of shit son, who was actually driving recklessly. The rest of it was even more sickening because all the two of them were obsessed with talking about is making sure that they set him up for a reality show when he got out of prison. Remember that whole thing? Reality? Reality? The reality is that sometimes the people you grow up watching on TV and having fond memories of turn out to be despicable human beings. So I find none of this to be surprising. William from Calgary. Do you have any details about the Hulk Hogan-Richard Belzer incident that took place before WrestleMania 1? And what was the aftermath? Well, Richard Belzer had a TV talk show at the time. I don't remember the name of it. and he had Hogan and Mr. T on to promote WrestleMania. This was only a few days before the show. And Belzer was a comedian. He was an actor and a comedian. He would make jokes, but he clearly was not a fan. He was poking fun at them, and he wanted Hulk to demonstrate a move on him. Mr. T actually had enough sense to say no, and Belzer just kept insisting on it. So Hulk got up to go do it. And Hulk chose the simplest move that he could think of, which was a front chin lock. And he cinched up on it, and Belzer went, like, within seconds, Belzer went out. His body went limp. Where Hulk fucked up was that he let him go. He let him slip out of his grip, and Belzer just dropped to the floor. He was dead weight. And he smacked the back of his head on the floor, split his head open. And he needed 9 stitches to close the wound. Hulk should have known enough to set him down gently when he realized that the guy was dead weight. And you could even see the puddle of blood on the ground when he finally came to. Like, Hulk's smacking him around, and he finally comes to. Hulk helps him up. And then Hogan sees the blood dripping down the back of his suit jacket, and he didn't know what to do. And Belzer, he popped right back up and said, "We'll be right back." And he pitched it to a commercial, but he was on Dream Street. Like, he was on autopilot. I'm not saying Hulk did it to him on purpose, but, you know, back then, wrestlers were very protective of the business. This was not long after the incident where David Schultz slapped John Stossel in the ear twice, when Stossel told him to his face that he thought wrestling was fake. Right? Then, well, he's got to prove to him that I'll show you how fake it is. And so he got smacked. It's John Stossel, so I can understand it. When they came back from break, though, on the show here, Hulk and T, they were there. Belzer was not there. And there was some guy, he was like the producer, maybe he was the executive producer of the show, explaining that Richard had left. He had gone to the hospital. And Hulk apologized for what happened. He looked shell-shocked by the whole thing, probably because he knew he was going to get sued. But he's like, you know, he apologized for what happened. And it was funny because he made some comment to the effect of, I didn't realize that this man did no physical training or like physical activity of any kind. And everybody in the audience laughed. And Hogan was like, "No, I'm not trying to be smart. I'm just, you know, I'm sorry. I'm not trying to be smart. I'm just saying, you know," because Belzer was, I mean, he was like a skinny nothing. And Hogan was just this monster of a man. And so anyway, he apologized and said, "This is why, you know, we tell people don't do this at home." But I'm sure he was worried about getting sued. And he was. Belzer sued him for $5 million. They ended up settling out of court before it went to trial. And Belzer ended up buying a house in France with the money that he got from the lawsuit. Belzer died in that house last year. When he passed away, it was in that house in France. It was the house that Hogan paid for. That was the most expensive front chin lock ever applied. Binder from Milwaukee. Hulk Hogan, boy, this is the Hogan hour here. Hulk Hogan has said that in the past, even on his most recent appearance with Chris Van Vliet, that he wishes he used a different finishing maneuver than the leg drop. What do you think an alternate finishing move would have been for Hogan? This may be one of the few things he says that I actually believe. I believe it. I mean, the man had 10 back surgeries. You can't fake that. I'm sure he regrets using that leg drop every single day he wakes up in the morning. He could have used the Axe Bomber. The Axe Bomber was his finish in Japan. It was a clothesline, but it was kind of more of like a, oh, what do they call it? Like a crooked arm lariat. So instead of extending his arm completely straight out, it's more or less the same thing. It's just kind of a little crooked, and he just clotheslines the shit out of you. And he was a big guy back then, so, you know, he clotheslines you, you weren't going to get up. That was the finish that he used over there. And if you think a clothesline is too simple to use for a finish, well, so was a leg drop, but I think he made it work. Neil from North Carolina, I don't know how good Stephanie Vaquer's English is, but if it's not great, do you think William Regal would be a good mouthpiece for her? Do you think that this could work when she comes to NXT? No. William Regal managing Stephanie Vaquer, it's not a good fit. That doesn't work. Sam from Lancashire, UK. I was thinking Solo Sikoa should get a wise man to counter Paul Heyman when he returns to TV for the Civil War. But upon further reflection, I believe a female would be better. If you look at the factions on the main roster, they mostly have about three or four men and one woman. Judgment Day has Liv Morgan. Wyatt has Nikki Cross. American Maid has Ivy Nile. Final Testament has Scarlett. Legado del Fantasma has Electra Lopez. LWO has Zelina Vega. After the feud with Roman is done, should Bloodline 2.0 continue to stay together and feud with another faction, it would also give the female in that group someone to get physical with. The question is who? Given the family tree, my choice would be The Rock's daughter, Ava. I don't watch NXT, so I'm not sure how good she is in the ring or on the stick, but The Rock's daughter being in direct opposition to Roman Reigns could make for an interesting thread for when Dwayne comes back. I'm not really a fan of the idea of going with Ava. What I have seen of her as the GM in NXT, she's growing into the role. You know, she's okay. She's fine. I don't think she's ready for a spot like this, though. I just don't. You know, she might be one day. I'll tell you, the first name I thought of when I got your question, and you mentioned a female member, and there's no family ties, but then again, there was no family ties with Paul Heyman, as far as like blood, like a blood tie. I know Heyman was, you know, many years ago, you know, friend of the family. But like, Heyman's not part of the family. Sami Zayn wasn't part of the family. The Tongans, I mean, technically they're not part of the family, even though they consider them to be. So it wouldn't be that much of a stretch to bring in somebody from the outside. First name I thought of, and I don't think she's available, is Selena De La Renta. Everything I've ever seen from Selena De La Renta, mostly from MLW, she's very good. And I feel like someone like her would do well in a spot like that. But she's seemingly doing well for herself in MLW. She's got a lot of responsibilities there. And, you know, I don't think that there's any desire on her part to go anywhere. But if she was to become available and they wanted a female member of the Bloodline, I would consider her for the spot. Rajan from Hanover, Germany. I want to get your thoughts on the story for the world heavyweight title of WrestleMania 22. Would it not have fit better if Chris Benoit got the spot instead of Rey Mysterio? Benoit was known to be Eddie's best friend, and story-wise, it didn't make much sense to have Rey in that spot after the battle for the custody of Dominic the previous summer. I mean, you could say the same thing about Chavo Guerrero. Would it not have made more sense to push Chavo after Eddie died? I mean, the reason they didn't push Chavo is because he wasn't a main eventer. He's a mid-carder. That's all he was. Benoit was a main eventer. He was a former world champion, but he wasn't over in the way that Rey Mysterio was at that point. This was their chance to push Rey to a top spot. I'm sure he was also a big merch mover at the time, more than Benoit would have been. Benoit already got his Royal Rumble win. He got his WrestleMania title win 2 years before this. You know, this was an attempt to use Eddie's death, which is what they did. They used his death to help elevate Rey and tell the underdog story, right? Although they had teased Rey as a possible number one contender for Batista's title even before Eddie passed away. I vaguely remember a segment with Teddy Long, and I think it was the network executive guy, Palmer Cannon, and there was some kind of segment. I think Teddy was about to announce who the number one contender was going to be, and Cannon pulls the mic away and announces Eddie as the number one contender. It looked like Teddy was going to announce Rey Mysterio. I don't remember exactly when. I know it was after the ladder match for Dominic. Now, it may have just been a swerve to then bring Eddie out that night, and that was it, nothing more. But I do wonder if they had plans for Rey to at least get one match for the title at some point around that time. Or if Eddie had eventually won the belt from Batista, if maybe he would have dropped it to Rey. I mean, that would have been interesting, right? Eddie was the one who put Rey over in that Halloween Havoc match for the Cruiserweight title in WCW. So imagine all these years later, he's putting Rey over again, but this time is for the World Championship. Sufi from Malaysia. Do you know any reason why WWE has not done a PLE in Madison Square Garden? Currently, they only do TV and house shows there. Also, could you see AEW holding a show in MSG anytime soon? No, I don't see AEW running Madison Square Garden anytime soon. They have enough trouble filling buildings half the size of Madison Square Garden. They're not running the Garden. WWE doesn't run there very often because it's very expensive to do so. I think it's the same reason they run Allstate and not the United Center whenever they go to Chicago. Yeah, it's like, why spend the extra money for the Garden when they can just run the Barclays Center in Brooklyn? It's not that far away. But they have not, believe it or not, they have not run a pay-per-view at Madison Square Garden since Survivor Series in 2011. That's 13 years. Unless I'm missing one event between then and now, that's 13 years. Comes down to cost. You know, to me, MSG lost a lot of its charm when they renovated and they got rid of that short aisleway. It had its own personality, and then they got rid of it, you know? I mean, I've heard Bruce Pritchard say that he hated the way it looked there because it was always so busy in the background with people walking around that made the show seem uninteresting. I disagree. I thought it gave the show's personality. Without it, it just looks like every other arena now. But it comes down to money, you know? It's not that they can't afford it with all the money they make now, but again, why run the Garden when you could just run Barclays for cheaper? Damon. In Jacksonville, I just got done listening to the Raw review, and you mentioned Rick Rude and the Atomic Drop, which got me thinking. Buy, sell, rent, or leave on the shelf of basic non-finisher wrestling moves that have seemingly gone away. The Atomic Drop, the Inverted Atomic Drop, the Abdominal Stretch, and the Back Body Drop. I'm going to buy on the Back Body Drop, because we definitely don't see those as much as we used to. I used to love those calls, man. Big back body drop, back body drop. We don't get those as much. I'm going to rent on the Atomic Drop. I'm going to sell on the Inverted Atomic Drop. And I'm going to leave off the Abdominal Stretch because, I mean, the Abdominal Stretch is still very much around. I don't think it's gone away. Jesse from Johannesburg, South Africa gets the final word here. Longtime listener. He listens religiously, he says, to the show. Bleacher Report dropped their top 25, and he made me look it up. It's actually top 50, best WWE theme songs of all time. I wanted to ask for your thoughts and if you had a top 5 WWE theme songs ever. So this, like I said, maybe go check the list. Their top 5 were Stone Cold Steve Austin, The Undertaker, who's had 1,000 different theme songs, and most of them great, but he's had so many of them. Chris Jericho, Randy Savage, and Edge with Metalingus by Alter Bridge. All fine choices. I have said in the past many times that Real American is my favorite wrestling theme of all time. It's crazy to think it wasn't even intended for Hogan. I just love the song. So that's my number one. If I had to round out my top 5, I would have Shawn Michaels. I would have Bret Hart. I would have Demolition. And I would have Hollywood Rock. I think in no particular order, I think that would round out my top 5. But there are plenty of theme songs I love that I would consider for a spot there. I mean, I loved DDP's Nirvana knockoff theme in WCW. Kane's original theme and his Slow Chemical theme too. I thought that was badass. Undertaker's themes, of course, those were great. Cody's theme, Kingdom, is a great song. So thank you for the questions. TheSoloMonster@gmail.com is the place where you can reach me. And of course, you could also follow me on X at SoloMonster. The next time I will be live with you will be after AEW All In tomorrow. As I am recording this, it is Saturday, so that is Sunday, later in the afternoon. You can find me on there. Monday night, I'll be live for the Raw review. Tuesday night, you can catch me on Tuesday Night Titans over on JD's channel. We had a huge show this past week, and I'm sure we'll have plenty to talk about coming out of All In this week. And then Dynamite on Wednesday night. Oh my God, there's so much. SmackDown on Friday. Bash in Berlin is next Saturday. Episode 877 of the podcast is next Sunday. And then, of course, there's Raw, TNT, Dynamite. Then I fly out to Chicago on September 5th because we have a House of Glory show I got to work that night. And then I fly back the next day just in time to come home for SmackDown. And then All Out is that Saturday. Great. Tremendous. Anyway, I will see you back here for A77 next Sunday, if I'm still standing. So until then, be well. Stay safe. Have yourselves a great week. Enjoy All In. It should be a great show. And I will see you back here next week for more Sound Off. Until then, take care, guys.
The Sala Monster Sounds Off.
No, it would be like eating a burger without the bun. That's like the new thing now, people. No bun. Really? Yeah, no bun. I'll have my hot dog without the bun. I'll have my burger without the bun. Unless there's like a medical reason for you not to have the bun. What the fuck are you doing? You have a burger on a bun. You don't put it on a plate and cut it up into little pieces.
The Sala Monster Sounds Off. Each week, bursting with content. Podcasts, predictions, reviews, YouTube live streams, and more. Become a channel member for perks and follow the Sala Monster on Twitter at Sala Monster.
Sala Monster.
Sala Monster. Sala Monster Sounds Off.